ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This episode of Speaking Out contains discussions of domestic violence and suicide. If this conversation raises any issues, you can find support by calling 1-800-RESPECT or Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Behrendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
I didn't think I was getting it as bad as others. I thought that, you know, well, I'm not walking around with black eyes and no teeth. And so it was like a real... And that's like when you're in it, you can't see past the end of your own nose. So I realised that I didn't like being hit. You know, no one likes being hit. But I also, I didn't want to let him go. I felt lucky to have him. So my self-esteem wasn't as high as I thought it was, you know, because I thought, oh, I've got him. And it's that thing of not having a father. I wanted my kids to know their father. And a lot of women stay because they want their kids to have a father or know their father. And I've learnt now, in hindsight, there's so many times where had I left at that time, then my children wouldn't have been so impacted by what they've seen by me staying. So that's where the guilt, sets in.
Ashley Donoghue on domestic violence, how she got out, and what she's doing to help other First Nations women. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Behrendt. Domestic violence is an issue which continues to disproportionately impact First Nations communities. Ashley Donoghue was very clear about what domestic violence is and how its impacts can ricochet through families and communities. She knows because she survived a domestic violence relationship. She understands the particular complexities in Indigenous communities and the added layer of challenges for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women in reporting their perpetrators. Ashley knows firsthand the difficulties women face getting themselves and their children out of an abusive and violent home. She's honed in on the challenges of escaping with a memoir called Because I Love Him. Ashley has worked in Sydney for the Aboriginal community for more than 20 years, including at the Mudjingal Aboriginal Women's Centre in Redfern, where she's now the CEO. She's presented at the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women in New York several times, advocating against violence. Ashley's a proud Dungari woman. Her people come from the Maclay region around the New South Wales mid-north coast. Ashley Donoghue, welcome to Speaking Out.
Thank you for having me, Larissa.
So one of the ways we usually start off when we've got guests like yourself here on Speaking Out is to get a bit of a sense of your background and where you grew up and where... your sense of social justice of right and wrong comes from. So can you tell us a little bit about where the Ashley story started?
I certainly can. Well, I'm a proud Dungari woman born and raised in Kempsey on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. I come from a big Aboriginal family and grew up in a big Aboriginal community in Kempsey. Did all my school there. I loved Kempsey growing up, like it was because it was back, you know, I'm 55, so back then it was those, you see the memes now, like when Nan whistled from the window, you get home, when the lights went on, you get home, you know, and the community looked after us. I was brought up on the beach too, like my grandfather who raised me was one of the best fishermen considered. So I learnt how to, you know, get ocean worms and jag fish down at the Milo place. So we grew up very cultural too in that aspect. And like I said, I grew up as a fair-skinned Aboriginal girl who I didn't realise I was any different until I left Kempsey because I was just one of the Donoghue girls. So I never had any issues of, you know, like, you know how it is now? Like people are getting called out for being fair-skinned. I never had any of that because I grew up, you know, with my family in community. I come from very humble beginnings. My mother was sent to Sydney to clean houses at 15, got pregnant with me, booked into the Crown Street Hospital, and one of the old aunties said, no, you've got to get home, because they were still taking babies from Aboriginal women, especially if the father of the baby was white. And, you know, she was only 16, so she got sent home to Kempsey. Had me on the 31st of December, and back then Aboriginal women weren't allowed in the actual hospital. So she was on what was called the veranda ward, which is where they put Aboriginal women, which was just a veranda with green mesh around it. My first bed and home was a fishing basket in a tin shack on the banks of the Haddad Creek. So very humble beginnings. And I guess, you know, my grandmother was one of the staunchest women I know. She had all up 15 children, not one taken, even living in a camp, and how we grew up. And she also read her grandchildren. So I'm the eldest grandchild. So I was kind of special to her because I didn't know at the time, but it was like helping me to know how to help her when she got older. So when she got sick, it was my job. I was in Sydney then to go home and look after her, and that's what I did. So it's that grounding of looking after each other, and especially, you know, women, because I come from a predominantly female family.
Just in, you know, my time of knowing you, I've always been struck by the fact that you have a very strong sense of community and a very strong sense of who you are, a very strong sense of identity. So it's interesting to see how that obviously was planted at a very early age in a lot of strong women in your life. It explains why you've become such a powerful advocate. Now, you've been very public about your experiences with domestic violence as a way of really helping others. Tell me about what happened in your family and the extent of that violence.
Growing up, because I didn't know my father, so I'd never seen my mother in a domestic violence relationship, but growing up in an Aboriginal community that was very close, I seen Nan and Pop have a few arguments and, you know, but I never ever seen him put his hands on her in any way. But I did see in the community, like, you know, one of my favourite aunties and uncles growing up, I didn't actually see it, but I heard it, and that triggered me. And I'd seen my first boyfriend. I had a first boyfriend who actually did hit me, and I didn't realise at the time was domestic violence because he was punching me in the arm or something. But I seen him a couple of years later, like, assaulting his then partner, like, out the front of the house, and I run out and I said, "What are you doing? Stop." So I knew, we were always brought up, that's one thing that my mum done, no one is to put their hands on you. Wear good shoes, brush your teeth, and, like, go to school. these were her things, like, you know, she had this thing about shoes, and so, you know, that was passed on, and this thing of, I don't know, like, I didn't really see it, but, like, you'd go to football games and you'd see it. You know, back then when you'd go to the knockout, if there was a fight, everyone would run to it. Like, domestic violence was a little bit more visual in community settings, and it still is. Like, you know, they've got people fighting each other on Facebook, like, you know, videotape and things like that. But I think it was my own experience that led me down this path. It wasn't, though, that I chose to be a domestic violence advocate. It was just because I'd gone through that relationship that was very violent. And when I come out of it, I thought, what was it, you know, what was I doing? Like, one of the things people don't talk about enough in domestic violence relationship is the guilt that the victim carries and the guilt of allowing yourself to be treated so badly. Because I look at this man now, and I could probably push him over and it'd break in half. So to be so fearful of someone who you're not fearful of now makes you, like, think, oh, geez, what was I thinking?
You have always seemed to me like such a strong person. You know, I've seen you be such a leader in the community, such an advocate for other women. From your own perspective, when you look back, how was it that somebody who had, you know, such a strong sense of self growing up, strong sense of identity, strong female role models, was it that you found yourself in that kind of relationship?
I didn't think I was getting it as bad as others. I thought that, you know, well, I'm not walking around with black eyes and no teeth. And so it was like a real, and that's like when you're in it, you can't see past the end of your own nose. So I realised that I didn't like being hit. You know, no one likes being hit. But I didn't want to let him go. I felt lucky to have him. So my self-esteem wasn't as high as I thought it was, you know, because I thought, oh, I've got him. And it's that thing of not having a father. I wanted my kids to know their father. And a lot of women stay because they want their kids to have a father or know their father. And I've learnt now In hindsight, there's so many times where had I left at that time, then my children wouldn't have been so impacted by what they've seen by me staying. So that's where the guilt sets in. So it was just this thing, but I just loved him. I absolutely loved him, and I'd kick him out, and I wasn't scared to call the police, and he knew that. But it was just then, it was like I swear my body would ache for this man. And that's another thing people don't talk about in the domestic space is that sexual attraction. Because in DV, as soon as you sleep with your partner after any incident, it's back to normal. It just goes back and then it continues on. And they may call that the honeymoon cycle or whatever it else, but as soon, it doesn't matter what they've done, as soon as you sleep with them, whether it's who you with a man, woman or whatever, it goes back to the start. It's like a monopoly game.
And you did mention that you've obviously reflected and you advocate when you're talking in this space about the impact on children in these sorts of situations. What do you want people who are in a domestic violence relationship to think about in relation to how it's impacting on their children from what you've understood from your own experiences and in your work?
Yeah. One of my worst assaults happened at a hostel. And so there was lots of people around. My children were home. They didn't see it. I didn't think my son or my daughter seen it. But years after, it came to light that when I'd run into the bathroom and my head was split open, so it was like a tap, like a bubbler, blood coming from my head. I was covered in blood. He'd seen me, and I never ever knew. I never ever knew he'd seen me. So when you think kids don't see, they do see, but they don't even have to see. They hear it, they feel it. They understand the tension between parents, and so all those little emotions are bubbling inside these little people who don't understand what's going on but feel whatever the mother's feeling and whatever the father or partner's feeling at the time. It's that sensory stuff that kids feel, and they carry that with them, you know, throughout their life. And it's detrimental to them. It's even if you live near somebody, like the domestic violence isn't happening in your house and you live next door to somebody and you can hear them being assaulted or abused in any way. And that, if you can hear them, the children can hear them. So if you're impacted, the children are impacted. So, you know, it's that hearing and feeling that is just as detrimental to little people as it is in the seeing.
You speak so honestly about these situations, which really helps people to understand the complexities of it. And I think one of the very powerful things of your advocacy is you talk about how domestic violence occurs in ways that aren't physical as well as the physical ways. What are some of the ways in which it's manifested, particularly in your own experience, that perhaps aren't physically violent but are still incredibly controlling?
Yeah, the father of my children was extremely jealous. He thought I was Elle Macpherson or someone, you know, and maybe I was back then, and I didn't know it, you know what I mean? So if anyone would talk to me, even my cousins, like I was playing basketball out the back with my cousin once and he got jealous of that, like, you know, if I was sitting down having a meeting with anyone. When I worked at Courier Radio, the boss was a man, he was jealous. So that jealousy thing, and people like to think, oh, that jealousy thing isn't violent. It's like, oh, he cares. It's not. It's because it's trying to get that control of who you can talk to. So it's those things. It's that love bombing, they call it now. Like, you know, he told me he loved me the second time we got together. And I thought, oh, my God, he loves me. You know what I mean? So it's those things like that. And we were young and I don't think we knew what we were doing, but and that grew into that violence of, and he had me believing I trapped him. So that's that mental thing, like, you know, I could have been this, I could have been that. And I was saying, well, I didn't stop you from being that or this or, but I could never voice it then because I couldn't articulate what it was I was trying to think. And that's why it's so important for our young people to understand what domestic violence looks like. And it's not just physical violence. It's all these things like telling them who they can have on Facebook, the joint Facebook accounts, you know, moving you away from your family and your friends, the isolation, all that stuff, the giving gifts and whatnot, and wanting you to, oh, you don't need to be with them, just be with me. We only need each other. That kind of stuff, that all, you know, it's that love at first sight stuff, that all that giddiness when you fall in love. But it's all, there's a fine line between that giddy love, young love, and that giddy possession, power and control.
Just one other aspect that I know you understand deeply is also the financial control, the control of money.
Yeah, well, so I was the breadwinner. Like I worked, he kind of worked on and off too, but he'd done a lot of jail too. So, and this is another thing in the space of prison, that the role of Aboriginal women, especially as prison wives, as mothers, you know, you've only got to look at some of the deaths in custody. It's all Aboriginal women leading, like, you know, Aunty Tonna from Kempsey, her son. So it's that, you know, maternal female, you know, role in that space that isn't done. But he controlled, like, the money. And so there was this, back in the day, you could get a what were they called? I don't know, these cards where you could go and buy furniture and whatnot. But you had to pay them then at the post office. So I'd give him the money to GE cards, they were GE cards, to pay it. But little be known to me, like I'd give him that money and then he could go and withdraw it as soon as he put it in there. And so I was wondering why this wasn't, why I wasn't getting anywhere with this thing. And so he left me in debit the credit cards, which I knew nothing of, but also that control of payday, he was there. One day I was so, like, depressed with everything else and I went across the road. I worked at Marrickville Council. I went across the road and I gambled my whole pay and I walked out and it was the first time in my whole life I've ever thought, oh, I just could end it. And I seen a bus coming. I thought if I just walked in front of that bus, it'd all stop. So that's the extent that that financial abuse can take, that leads you to that, because then I was thinking, how am I going to feed my kids? How am I going to pay the rent? What's he going to do to me? So it was all these things that come about. And lucky enough, I could ring my sister and I just said, oh, I told her what happened. I said, oh, you've got to help me. And so she gave me enough money to get me through without him noticing that I'd done anything.
Given the picture you paint of the multifaceted way in which domestic violence can take control of your life, and it did, how did you find the courage to break that cycle? Tell us the story of how you got out of this situation.
Oh, look, Larissa, I read this quote sometime, and this is the story I'll tell you is why I believe that, and it said that people will tolerate in abusive relationships the extent of violence that they experienced growing up, right? My mother used to throw shoes at me because I was, you know, cheeky and I could run fast, so, and she didn't want to get up and chase me, so she'd throw a shoe at me and then I'd have to get it and take it back to her, right? So by the time I'd left, like, the worst assault had happened and there was continual assaults and control. One night we come home in a taxi. It was after Yarban, actually, and, like, he jumped in the taxi with me and, like, he bashed my head against the taxi window and whatnot. And we got home and he was just going on and, like, you know, working his way up, and he took his shoe off and he threw it at me down the hallway. And the shoe hit me in the back of the ankle and something in me just went, that's it. So I went down because mum was in the house. I got her phone, I called the police. And then he said, I'll be back in the morning. And I said, well, you won't be back here. And I knew there and then that that was it, and that was it. So I went to the police and the old sergeant helped me out and everything else. I got a 5-year AVO, but it was that shoe, because growing up, in that little microchip that babies have from inception to, you know, whatever it is that carries, that to me was it. And in all the years I've done this work, I've heard so many women say, oh, I knew that as soon as he broke a bone, I'd leave him. As soon as whatever it was that was their tipping point happened, they would leave. Now, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, a lot of women will say, oh, we should just hit me, so then there's an excuse to leave. So it's like you always need this permission or something sort of happen for you to leave, and everyone's tipping point is different.
You do talk about that danger of, you know, the cycle of having some incident happen where there's an escalation of the violence and then there is a reconciliation, and women in these situations, or men in these situations, get into that cycle. What was it in you that just knew that the cycle could stop, that this wasn't the time that you would go back again?
I'd found Mudjingal at that time. So I started there as the bookkeeper. So I often say, like, had Mudjungle not found me, I probably wouldn't be standing here talking to you today. So it was being around women who were talking about things that I was experiencing and me sitting there thinking, oh, geez, that's me. I'm like, it's not just, I'm not the only one type thing. Like, you know, like, and so it was just hearing about it and then learning and understanding of Bronwyn Penrith, of Dixie Link Gordon, you know, of the team at Mudjungle at the time. My best friend Melita Link was one of the guiding lights in, because she was just ending her relationship when I'd become her friend. And I remember she got her hair streaked for the first time and I thought, oh, I'm going to go and do that. And she walked right around so that, like, she'd left him, but so that he didn't see her. So it's like, you know, that thing, oh, well, I can do that too. And so it was really being in that space, and that's why I'm so passionate about Mudjungle, and that why I reckon every little town and, you know, suburb needs an Aboriginal women's space where we can just go and be and learn off each other and understand that sometimes the way we're treated isn't the right way. Well, a lot of the times, you know, so, yeah.
Mudjungle has played such an important role in the lives of families in Redfern and women. Tell us a little bit about the many, many services and activities that an Aboriginal women's service engages in, because, you know, I look at the sort of work that Mudjungle does and it's so multifaceted. Mm. Tell us a little bit about the scope of the work that goes on in Mudjungle.
Well, the reality is that we're supposed to, we've got two streams of funding, one from federal and one from the, you know, the other one, I can't think what it's called. DCJ, and they only, so that's only like one program. So that's a 1,000 days program, which is set up to reduce the risk of Aboriginal women having their babies removed at birth, and the other one is the family support. We get fund, that's the only government funding that comes in there. Every other bit of money that comes through, we've got philanthropical money for our very first domestic violence worker in 31 years. The government has never, ever funded that organisation for a domestic violence or sexual assault worker. So we're essentially a drop-in centre. So that means that we don't have a criteria. Any Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander woman walk through that door, we do our very best to advocate for, help and refer on. We get a lot of rough sleepers coming in because we have a shower that they can utilise, and we've got these bags with towels and whatnot in through our donations and me going and doing talks at organisations. They say, what do you want? Well, that works a treat for us with a voucher in it for them to go and, you know, buy themselves something nice. But we have a shower, we have a washing machine and dryer. So there's this multifaceted service in there that's only funded by two streams of government funding, and we rely heavily on philanthropic money and donations to keep it afloat. So we have women with mental health, we have women that's going through legal issues. That's why we've got a team up. We've got Redfern Legal Centre that comes in once a month and does sits there all day and helps any Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander woman come through who's going through court stuff. We get our play group does things like swimming and first aid for kids and all these other activities. We have arts and crafts where women can just sit around and be, because we don't all have to be going through anything to access and use Mudjungle.
Having said that, you also do cater to people who otherwise fall through the cracks, and I'm thinking about the rough sleepers, yeah, the women who are in a domestic violence situation, the women coming out of prison.
Yeah.
I find it shocking that there are only two funding streams and yet your service would be dealing with the most vulnerable people in the Redfern community.
Our service deals with all the people, all the people that everyone else says they're advocating for. That's what our service does. And we miss out sitting at these big tables and whatnot because we're only a, you know, metropolitan area. We're not statewide or anything like that. But it boggles my mind because it's been there for 31 years, you know, working with and for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, and it's proven its power by its still door still being open. And the funny thing is that when, like with the referendum and whatnot, all the ministers and whatnot wanted to come to Mudjungle. You know, I started saying no. I said, no, why? Why? So that you can make out that you're helping us when you really don't. My thing is around this, Larissa, is that I don't understand why an Aboriginal, 100% run by and for Aboriginal Women's Centre needs to prove to the government that they need funding. They've done all the research. They know all the statistics. The proof is already there. Organisations like Mudgingal should just be put on five-year funding plans because we're doing the work. We're doing the work that they're telling us where the problem is. We're doing that work, and yet they won't fund us. So when you've got to jump through all these hoops to get the funding and whatnot, I think, well, why are we trying to prove to them when they've already done the research and they've, you know, and they've got all this stuff already? Like, what's the proof?
I guess the other thing I'd add to that, because we're very big advocates of community control on speaking out, partly because it's exactly what you're saying there, that the members of the community understand what the issues are.
Yeah.
Just as importantly, they understand what the solutions are. And it strikes me that that is also the role that Mudgingal plays. It very much never does a one-size-fits-all and has to deal with each individual person who walks through the door, but do it in a way where sometimes the solutions could seem very simple. Like you're saying, a shower, washing machines, a voucher. From your experience there, can you share with us sometimes or some examples of how you have seen just those simple understandings of a thing that can make a difference change somebody's life?
I'll tell you two scenarios. One scenario was one of the women who's not local, but she comes in often when she's off her medication, mental health medication. She was rolled up at the front door in a doona. Now, she can get abusive and whatnot, but we know her and we know what to do. And generally what she wants to do is just come in and have a sleep. So we let the lady, there's two rough sleepers that will come and just, we let them upstairs because we've got this fold-out, like, bed thing, and we just let them sleep because they just want somewhere safe to sleep. And so we do that. But if that was a non-Aboriginal organisation, they probably would have went off on stress sleep. You know what I mean? So that line of what of our tolerance is much more culturally appropriate. And this is my big gripe, all the things that they produce and all the plans and everything are seen through a white lens, and that white lens doesn't see Aboriginal women. So that's one. So we deal with her on, you know, at least three times a year, but we understand what she's going through and we know what she needs. And that's our thing. We are there for the woman. So whatever they want is what we do. There was this one incident where a woman, she came, she wasn't from New South Wales. She'd travelled down, her partner was white. He'd assaulted her, and she'd been taken to the hospital and all she had was her phone. So she went to the hospital and she wasn't bashed up enough to stay in hospital. So she walked outside and she thought, oh, what's that across the road? And it was the mental health hospital. So she went and signed herself into the mental health hospital because she knew that she'd be there for 3 days where she was safe. Now, she could have went out and slept rough. She could have went out, stole a car. She could have went out and, you know, done something. But that was the extent. This is the extent Aboriginal women are going to keep themselves safe. So she went over there. She was okay. You know, she was upset and depressed and whatnot, so they let her stay there. Then she asked, oh, can you contact an Aboriginal women's centre for us? So they contacted us. All she wanted us to do was pick her up, take her to the centre. She wanted to shower, and we've got these DV packs. So she was able to go and get some clothes and come back and stay there. And then all she wanted was a lift to get home because her parents had made sure that she got home, and that was all she wanted. But what people don't realise is now if she has a baby, there's a likelihood that she'll have a birth alert and be at risk of losing her baby because she had stayed in a mental health hospital. So that's how that vicious cycle, by her wanting to keep herself safe, and at that time there was no other alternative, that was the best choice for her.
You're listening to my conversation with Ashley Donoghue, domestic violence survivor and activist. Ashley said that after she finally managed to leave her violent partner in 2007, it was a no-brainer to dedicate her career to supporting First Nations people dealing with DV.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABC RN, Radio Australia on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. We'll hear more from Ashley Donoghue soon, but first some music from Electric Fields.
Ooh.
That was Electric Fields with one of their signature songs, Pacolpa.
Speaking Out with Larissa Behrendt.
The knowledge, the culture, the arts, the language, the law and customs of Indigenous people.
On ABC Radio.
Ashley Donoghue is the CEO of Mudjingal Aboriginal Women's Centre and works to prevent domestic violence. She says the Women's Centre in Redfern saved her when she escaped her violent partner, the father of her children. She's frustrated that the multifaceted service has to keep proving to the government that it deserves funding and knows what it's doing. Let's hear more from our conversation now.
One thing that strikes me too with the work that you do, we talk about all these different vulnerabilities that women have, but often in part of their story, there is an issue of domestic violence somewhere. Do you see that across the spectrum of the various experiences, women who are sleeping rough, women coming out of prison?
Yeah.
How prevalent is domestic violence as a factor?
It's I would say that 95, maybe 93%. Of all women that come into our service are affected by domestic violence or some form of abuse.
And it seems to me that one of the really important things that you do as Mudjingal and you as an advocate who have been through that lived experience is that this was an issue that people didn't talk about.
Mm.
It was supposed to be behind closed doors. And so just being able to name it and call it out is a really powerful thing. How have you seen a shift in the way people talk about domestic violence?
Well, more people know what it is. More people know that it's not okay. And so I think the message is getting out there, Larissa, but it's only getting out there through organisation when women come seeking for help or social media. Still in the big mainstream media, it's not getting out there enough. You know, you have to be the perfect victim to make the news and whatnot. So, and they're throwing the statistics around now like it, where it means nothing. You know, men are killing women a dime a dozen in this country. My thing is, I don't think that there is enough consequence. I personally think that there needs to be a law Australia-wide around domestic violence, regardless of race, wealth, or where you live. If you punch someone in the face in the Northern Territory, that's no different from punching someone in the face in New South Wales. It's still a punch in the face. So whether you live over the North Shore or in Redfern or wherever, so why should the consequence be different because of where you live or who you are or how much money you got? It should be Australia-wide. There needs to also be a definition of what domestic violence is Australia-wide. Because right now, you know, men are getting away with tying their wives to clotheslines and setting them alight. Where is that okay?
There's a interesting ongoing tension in the First Nations community. I'm old enough to remember when the Aboriginal Women's Legal Service was set up there. And I remember that there was a view in the community that I didn't share, but that the ALS should prioritise representing men because they would be on the criminal charges, and that kind of left women very vulnerable if they were in a domestic violence situation with no advocates. So services like the Women's Legal Service and Mudjingal became really critical in that. And I just wonder if over time you've seen a shift in how we deal with these issues.
Not in the legal space, no, because even now, like, there's conflict. So if it's two Aboriginal people and just say the partner's sister had an issue with the victim, that would be considered a conflict. So they couldn't work with them. So you know what I mean? So there's still all these things that put these barriers up where you think, oh, well, why can't they just what's the conflict? Like, you know, just... But there's these little loopholes that still prevent Aboriginal women, especially from getting proper legal, full legal help, unless they get someone to, what is it when they find someone outside?
Like an independent person?
Yeah, pro bono.
Oh, pro bono.
Pro bono. There we go, pro bono. So that sometimes works. But also a lot of our Aboriginal women's legal centres aren't set up for criminal law.
That tension then between it that occurs in the community of women calling the police on an Aboriginal family member, in some quarters would see the woman have a lot of criticism from the community around that. How are you shifting, or how are we shifting that perception that it's somehow not right to call the police in these situations, or to get help, or to seek legal action to resolve these issues?
That would be one of the hardest things that I find in this space, and that's namely because sometimes the victim is living with the family, or you're in the same area as the family, and so then that if you ring the police on their brother or their son, then there's a likelihood that there could be an altercation between the family. You know, that net of what happens in DV and family violence for Aboriginal people goes way further than any other nationality, because we are so, you know, linked and knowledgeable of who and where everyone comes from and who they are. And also we all understand, you know, deaths in custody. But what a lot of people don't understand is that Aboriginal women are the highest rate of women going into custody and deaths in custody also. I don't know if they're the highest rate, but, you know, it's on the increase. But the reality is that they are real realities, and so that instills fear. But one of the biggest concerns, Larissa, is the fact that if Aboriginal women ring the police, then DCJ are involved, and then that in turn is a bigger risk of them losing their children. So a lot of women will not ring the police for fear of losing their children.
It's such an example of how the system just doesn't work, isn't it? And that non-Indigenous people wouldn't even think of that. But this is such a real intersection. You've already given a couple of examples where fleeing a domestic violence situation has increased that likelihood. I've seen an instance in my own work where a woman had fled to a refuge, and DCJ deemed that refuge not safe to keep children in, so removed her children. These things highlight the fact that what the system, the systems that we work within are set up to do in terms of finding solutions, don't work. It points to why places like Mudjingal are so important. With looking at the extent to which you've worked in this area now, what would you like to see as some of the key law reforms and supports put in place that would make, from your perspective, a real difference?
Again, is have an Aboriginal Women's Centre in each suburb and country town. I've got this wonderful idea that if ever I get the money or win a lotto or marry some billionaire or something, I want to set up a service like that show The Maid. So I want to set up, it'll be like a motel that's got, you know, proper security and whatnot for women that are facing domestic violence that sometimes just need a night away. Or, you know, like we'll leave them, there'll be like little apartments for them to come with a mini Mudjingal in the middle of it, and services to come in and see each woman. And I think that, like, we have to restructure how we're helping our women, because what we're doing isn't working. And if it was, then there wouldn't be so many women being murdered or being victims of domestic violence. And that goes towards us as being mothers, grandmothers, sisters, partners, in-laws, because if you ask a room full of people, or who has a zero tolerance to violence, the majority of those people will put their hands up. Yet when it impacts them, when it's their son, their father, their brother, that line moves. And it happens in our communities too. How many people are more likely to charge a stranger as opposed to a member of the family or someone you love when they've bashed you or raped you? You know what I mean? People are more likely to charge a stranger. So we have to somehow change the systems to allow victims, whether men or women, to know that that line's not going to move. And we're not doing that because violence is, you know, it's out there. Like, I know, well, I'm not going to put the police on my son, but you're going to stand there and watch your son bash someone's daughter. You know what I mean? So we're not doing that well enough. And we're, you know, people blame men, but who's allowing the men to continue to be violent? I'm not blaming women either. I'm blaming society. Like, you know, all of us play a role. Everyone can make their homes, their communities, their areas as safe as they want, and that's determined by how much violence they're willing to tolerate. That's the basis. So how much are people willing to tolerate?
You've also spoken about the challenges of being a mother and being the and finding your son now in prison and the challenges of that. And I wonder if you could share what that part of your journey's been like for you. It's being such a strong advocate.
Yeah. Well, my son went to jail 2 weeks after he turned 18. Never got in trouble in his life. First offence, 12 months straight up. And it was the most, I was just gutted. I could not comprehend as to how that could happen. To the point where even the police, when they come down, they say, "Oh, Miss Donnie, we're so sorry. We didn't think he'd go to jail." You know. So this judge said, he said, "Oh, you look like you could have done it." So that was enough for him. But that 12 months was probably the hardest 12 months of my life, because then I reflected, see, I shouldn't have taken him to see his father. So all that guilt, you know, what did I do for my son to be in jail? And they kept moving him, Larissa, because he was no history of violence or drug taking or anything then. So he was this fresh 18-year-old big boy, and he was being moved around like a Maddie. But to top it all off, my mother was the Aboriginal welfare officer. And so I was saying, "Why can't you help him? Why can't you help him?" And she said, "Ash," this is what she said to me, "Ashley, not everybody likes me in here. If they find out that he's my grandson, that could put him in even worse danger." And I knew the dangers of jail because I was a jail wife. His father was in and out of jail all of his life and told me the stories of what happened in jail. And so I was that frightened for him. And that's why, you know, I think it's important. And this is where Aboriginal mums and partners don't get enough credit when they're supporting someone in jail. It's so important to make sure that you visit them, make sure that they're getting money in their accounts. And not because just to keep them, but because so the systems know that there's someone out there that cares about them. Because how many of our mob go to jail and nobody visits them or sends them money, and how many of those people are generally the ones that end up harmed or hurt in jail? Not all, but a lot, you know what I mean? So there needs to be places that monitor that too. But it was difficult. It was the worst year of my life to date.
I think you're extraordinary. We have a lot of extraordinary people on the show, but I would rank you as one of the highest, because I first came to know you really just through your work at Mudjingal and saw the impact that that community organisation has had on the lives of women in the community that I live in. And I've always really admired the people that were involved with them, Arnie Bronwyn, etc. And I saw you first in that context, and then I came to know you more and to hear you advocate. And I think there's such power in the way you use your personal story to relate to people and to teach us, to deepen our understanding. It can't be an easy thing to do, but I've always found you to be optimistic, to be positive, to be somebody who is always committed to change, never defeated. And I just wonder if you could share with us, where do you get that optimism for when you've had such difficult things to face and you see difficult things every day? What keeps you strong?
I've got 6 grandchildren. 4 of them are girls, and they range from dark brown to milky white. And I don't ever want any of them to walk into any place or be treated less than because of how they look, what colour their skin is, or because if they're a girl or a boy. So I'm guided by my grandmother, my mother. You know, I was lucky enough to know my 2 great-grandmothers, who were so staunch. And I think if my grandmother could have, you know, lived the life that she lived and didn't, you know, and stood staunch, then what are we? I say it all the time, we are more than our wounds. We are more than our wounds. And so we stand on the shoulders of giants. Lots of people say that, but we are more than our wounds. And if we don't acknowledge that and make it, you know, shine that light for the future generations, then we're doing a disservice to our matriarchs. And I refuse to ever be any kind of disrespect or anything to my mother, grandmother and great-grandmothers before me. I just refuse. And that's what keeps me going.
If somebody is listening now who is in a domestic violence situation and wants to change that, what is your advice to them?
To talk to who they think is going to help them in the moment. And that sometimes that is the police, and a lot of people don't want to ring the police, but if your life's in danger, always ring the police. Sometimes it's not your mum. Sometimes it's not your sister or your best friend. Sometimes it's the neighbour across the road. Sometimes it's someone at work. But reach out to someone who you know is going to listen to you. And I advise people, you know, who people disclose to actually listen to the woman. Don't think in your mind that you know what they need to do. Listen to her and do what she wants. And in this space, Larissa, I tell all the staff, there's a 50-50 chance that women will go back. So we can't take it personally, you know, because there's a 50-50 chance.
Mm.
And regardless if she goes back, when she comes back, we do the same. What do you want? What do you want me to do right now? You tell me what you want and I'll do whatever it is you want me to do. That's the best thing you can say to any woman that's in any form of violence or distress or anything.
Domestic violence is unfortunately statistically more common in First Nations families. Is this changing, and what can we do to change that statistic?
Well, it is a true statistic, but domestic violence doesn't discriminate. It doesn't matter if you're black, white or brindle. It doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. And you only have to, you know, everyone, I say this to the young groups that I talk to, who's heard of Rihanna? We've seen what Chris Brown done to her. And for the older groups, who watches the cooking show, Nigella Lawson, her husband grabbed her by the throat in a cafe in broad daylight, and her father worked for the Queen. So it doesn't matter of wealth or nationality. It happens in every single town, state, city in this world. But for our mob, we unless the systems are changed, like if there's some, you know, of how if you do report domestic violence and you're not going to have your children removed, if you do report domestic violence, someone's son, your husband, your partner isn't going to be killed in jail or in the cells or anywhere. So the racism and the violence from the systems still impacts our people so much more on such a higher level that it's hard to trust those systems to keep us safe. And that's the problem.
Ashley, thank you so much for all the work you've done, the power of your story and your storytelling, the impact of your advocacy. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Speaking Out.
Thank you.
That's Ashley Donoghue, domestic violence advocate and CEO of Mudjingal Women's Aboriginal Centre. If any of the topics covered in the program have raised issues for you, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's the National Domestic Family and Sexual Violence Counselling Support Service, and it's a free call. Or if you're experiencing thoughts of suicide, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's the show for now. Join us again next time when we bring you more inspiring stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Jay McAllister and Sarah Allerley. You can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.